From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S. President Barack Obama begins a four-nation trip to Europe. Ukraine calls off its truce with pro-Russian separatists. U.S. troops begin joint military exercises in Poland. And the announcement of results in the Afghan election is to be delayed. All these stories and more coming just ahead here on International Edition. Sitting in for Susan Yockey, I'm Dave DeForest. U.S. President Barack Obama has arrived in Japan for a week-long tour of Asia. The visit aims to reassure allies who are nervous about U.S. defense cutbacks as China moves to expand its influence in the region. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez is traveling with the president.
It was nearly 3 years ago the Obama administration announced what it called the Asia pivot. The term described a shift in foreign policy focus to Asia as the administration concluded wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But Asian allies have seen few U.S. military resources shifted to the region as the United States makes defense cuts, all while China builds up its military and pushes to gain control of more of the East and South China Seas. China is not one of the stops on the trip, but is on the minds of Mr. Obama and his Japanese allies, who are locked in a territorial dispute with Beijing over a group of small islands in the East China Sea. Those islands, known in Japan as the Senkaku and in China as the Diaoyu, are at the heart of Japan's concerns about the U.S. commitment to defend Japan. The United States says it will not take sides in the dispute. But prior to landing in Tokyo, President Obama told the Japanese newspaper Yomiuri Shimbun the islands fall under the U.S. mutual defense treaty with Japan, indicating the United States would defend Japan if China attacks and tries to take the islands by force. Mr. Obama said the United States opposes unilateral attempts to undermine Japan's administration of the islands. Speaking to reporters last Friday, National Security Advisor Susan Rice said the president's visit is an opportunity to underscore his continued focus on the Asia-Pacific region and to show the U.S. remains committed to the region's security.
Whether it ought to be viewed as a containment of China, I would say this trip has a very positive, affirmative agenda, and that's how we are looking at it, as an opportunity to solidify and modernize our alliances and partnerships, as an opportunity to advance our economic agenda.
Mr. Obama arrived in Tokyo late Wednesday, aiming to reassure Japan the U.S. pivot is on track. The U.S. leader headed to a private dinner with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who last week said he is eager to reaffirm the alliance. The Japanese leader said he wants to strengthen the Japan-U.S. alliance so it can contribute to peace and prosperity in the Asia-Pacific region. President Obama is also trying to help ease a strain in relations between Japan and South Korea over atrocities committed by Japanese forces against Koreans in the first part of the 20th century. U.S. officials believe the historical disputes are distracting from current security threats such as North Korea. South Korea is the next stop for President Obama, who will also travel to Malaysia and the Philippines. The president had originally scheduled this visit last year, but canceled it due to the government shutdown that resulted from a federal budget crisis. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, Tokyo.
Ukraine has formally called off the Easter truce with pro-Russian separatists in the east and says anti-terrorist operations are on again. First Deputy Prime Minister Vitaly Yarema told reporters during a cabinet meeting today that what he calls appropriate steps will be taken and that results will be seen shortly. Yarema said Ukraine has gotten assurances from the United States that it would not be left alone in the face of Russian aggression. He expressed hope that the U.S. support will be more substantive. In Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told state television Russia would retaliate if its legitimate interests or the Russian people are attacked. He said Russia's response would be the same as it was in South Ossetia in 2008, which led to a war with Georgia. U.S. Army paratroopers began joint exercises with their Polish counterparts today in Poland, with additional companies deployed in three Baltic states. VOA's Victor Beatty reports.
Kirby says a company of some 150 members of the 173rd Airborne Brigade Combat Team, based in Italy, will be part of a rotational U.S. military presence in Eastern Europe in the wake of tensions over Ukraine.
This new exercise is the first in a series of expanded U.S. land force training activities in Poland and the Baltic region that are scheduled to take place for the next few months and beyond. Additional companies from the 173rd will move in the coming days to Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia for similar exercises.
Initially, some 600 troops will take part in what Kirby calls a persistent rotational presence that will last about a month. He says fresh troops will then move in, and this presence could last a year or more. The spokesman says the United States is in consultation with its NATO allies, and the force could be expanded in size and scope of countries involved. Kirby was asked if the Ukrainian crisis accelerated this military activity.
Since Russia's aggression in Ukraine, we have been constantly looking at ways to reassure our allies and partners. And these exercises, they're two points. One, they're bilateral. They're between the United States and the country in question. It's not a NATO exercise. And number two, it's in response to that need by Secretary Hagel reaching out and talking to General Breedlove, talking to General Dempsey, and looking for ways that we can constantly reassure our allies and partners of our commitment to Article 5, to the alliance, but also to them and to their security. So it's all part of that.
Kirby says while these exercises were added because of tensions in Ukraine, the U.S. unit involved has worked with all four European countries in the past. The Pentagon spokesman says the message of these exercises is an explicit one to the four countries involved, that the United States is serious about its obligations under Article 5 of NATO, even though they are not NATO exercises.
If there's a message to Moscow, it is the same exact message that we take our obligations very, very seriously on the continent of Europe.
Kirby says Russia has done nothing to de-escalate the situation or make Ukraine and Europe any more stable. He said what would be helpful is if Russia would remove its forces from Ukraine's borders and take concrete steps to respect the sovereignty of Ukraine. The Latvian government welcomed the Pentagon announcement, calling it a fast and practical response. Lithuania's president says the deployments will strengthen our readiness for collective defense and add to ensuring the safety of our people. Estonia's defense minister says it will significantly increase his country's security. Kirby says the United States is encouraging its NATO partners to look for opportunities to take similar actions for each other. He also says the United States is providing more than $14 million in non-lethal aid to Ukraine's armed forces and state border guard. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Afghanistan's Election Commission has delayed releasing preliminary results from that country's April 5th presidential election to allow more time to investigate possible fraud. A vote count was expected on Thursday, but the Independent Election Commission said results will now be released on Saturday. Partial results put former Afghan Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah in the lead with 44%, followed by former World Bank economist Ashraf Ghani with 33%. Rival Palestinian groups Hamas and Fatah have agreed to implement a new unity agreement. In a joint press conference today, officials said the agreement entails the formation of a joint interim government within 5 weeks, followed by general elections in 6 months. The rival sides have announced similar agreements in the past, but have failed to implement them. The next phase in the search for the missing Malaysian Airlines passenger jet is likely to test the limits of existing technology. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Australian officials say they are consulting with counterparts in China, Malaysia, and the United States before deciding on what direction to take next in the search for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, missing since March 8th. Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott says a new search strategy will be needed if a U.S. Navy robotic submarine is unable to locate any trace of the 63-meter-long jetliner on the seabed floor. Mr. Abbott told reporters that the search will not be abandoned until we have done everything we can to solve this mystery. Australia's Defense Minister David Johnston says an announcement is expected next week, and it is likely to involve more capable side-scan sonar devices. Ron Allam, an Australian who designs vehicles for deep-sea exploration, tells VOA such technology, as described by the defense minister, has a proven track record.
That's a vehicle that was used to find the wrecks of Titanic and Bismarck and HMAS Sydney. I thought that would have been probably brought into play earlier.
Allam has dived in a submarine to a depth of 5,000 meters to help film the wreck of the Bismarck, a German battleship sunk by the British in the North Atlantic in 1941. The U.S. Navy's Bluefin 21 submersible has combed nearly all of the 310 square kilometer search area on the bed of the Indian Ocean off Australia's west coast, near where signals believed to be from the plane's black box were previously detected. So far, there has been no indication that its three-dimensional sonar map of the ocean floor has revealed anything relevant. Much of the seabed where the submersible has been deployed is uncharted and as deep as 7 kilometers. Alam says existing equipment's maximum operating depth is around 6 kilometers.
A towed device is going to be really at the limit of the cable as well, because if you lower a steel cable to the deepest part of the ocean, it will break under its own weight. So, yeah, the cable length can become an issue.
But Alam says looking for the plane's fuselage at that depth would be easier with a towed device than relying on the remotely operated robot submersible vehicles.
With a towed side scan, you've got immediate feedback. It's not limited by batteries. It doesn't have to come back to the surface to be downloaded. It can operate 24/7 behind a ship.
An air search involving 10 planes was suspended for a second consecutive day due to poor visibility and rough seas below. However, a dozen ships continued to search an area covering 38,000 square kilometers. No verified debris or oil from the plane has been spotted since it veered off course on March 8th. Photographs of an unidentified object, which washed ashore 10 kilometers east of Augusta in Western Australia, are being analyzed by specialists. The Malaysia Airlines flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing was carrying 239 passengers and crew. An unprecedented analysis of routine engine diagnostic signals from the Boeing 777 jet to satellites led searchers to a remote section of ocean far off the airliner's scheduled course. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington. Susan Yaki should be back next week.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
Thailand's Constitutional Court has given Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat until May 2nd to prepare her defense over abuse of power charges. Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok. The case comes amid continuing uncertainty as to when to hold a new election.
Thai Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat faces possible dismissal from office in two verdicts expected within weeks by the Constitutional Court and the National Anti-Corruption Commission, NACC. Wednesday, the Constitutional Court granted Ms. Yingluck leave to submit further evidence until May 2, as she faces abuse of power charges. Prosecutors allege she illegally transferred a former national security chief to Win Plainsari as part of a reorganization of senior security officials. An administrative court has already ruled against the government and ordered Tuwin's reappointment. A constitutional court verdict against Ms. Yingluck could require her to stand down as prime minister. The court may also order the cabinet led by the governing Pu'atai party to be dissolved. Ms. Yingluck also faces NACC charges of negligence in her role as chair of a National Rice Program Committee. Chulalongkorn University political scientist Panattan Wattanayagorn, a former government spokesman under the Democrat Party, says the Prime Minister is politically compromised.
The tipping point of the situation is, of course, the verdict of the court this month or next month regarding Yingluck. But there are many more cases against her. So her leadership, its political term, is over already. It's a matter of time. But the trouble is, can Pu'atai find a new leadership without any election to continue their power? If they cannot, the whole thing could collapse for them.
Anti-government protesters derailed national elections on February 2 by stopping registration of some candidates and some ballots. The Constitutional Court later annulled the vote. Ms. Yingluck continues to preside over a caretaker administration, but it lacks the mandate to pass a national budget and has other constitutional curbs on its power. This week, the Election Commission held talks with up to 60 political parties in an effort to re-establish parliamentary democracy. The current political crisis has led to more than 20 deaths and hundreds of injuries. Mardon University lecturer Gotamaria says there are fears of more clashes unless Thailand successfully moves ahead with new elections.
We don't have much time now. I pay more attention to the fact that yesterday, seemingly, the Election Commission may decide to organize the general election, let's say, with 60 to 90 days. In that case, the clock will start ticking again, and the time for negotiation is becoming shorter if we don't do anything of that sort. So we may head for confrontation.
Analysts say both sides have to negotiate to reconstitute parliament and government amid fears of the longer-term economic impact from the economic and political uncertainty. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Amidst pressure on Western governments to reduce their military expenditures, defense spending is increasing in other parts of the world, including the Middle East. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute says Middle East defense spending increased 4% overall from 2012 to 2013, but Oman and Saudi Arabia have seen significant increases. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi asks Michael O'Hanlon, Director of Research for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution, why military spending is increasing in the Middle East.
Well, I think you begin with Iran and Iran's rise and Iran's clear and ongoing interest in fomenting difficulty for many of the Arab states in particular, and certainly for its role in Syria, as well as Bahrain, Iraq, and other countries. In a broader sense, obviously, there's been instability that can be traced back to everything from the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 to the various Arab Spring developments of 2011. I don't know if most of those have really contributed to the big dollar defense purchases that Iran's rise has, however. They've certainly affected the security climate and in some countries contributed to instability or to a change in conditions. But I think if you're talking about the budgets, the big dollar ticket items, then it primarily is the rise of Iran, the nuclear programs of Iran, the activities of Iran in much of the surrounding area, and the desire of Arab states to respond firmly.
Would the huge Saudi military spending enable the kingdom to defend itself or improve its capabilities against a perceived Iranian threat?
Well, I think it'd be difficult to have confidence that the Saudis will absolutely be able to defend themselves. We know they have a modest-sized population, a big land area, difficulty in really creating a strong army. That's been an historical challenge for them. On the other hand, it's not that clear that Iran really would ever attack Saudi Arabia through an overland invasion. And the Saudis do have some clear capabilities in areas like air combat. And so some of the ways in which they might conceivably suffer from Iranian threats, they perhaps could do a pretty good job at handling. And rather than think of this as all or nothing, either they can totally defend themselves or they're, you know, defenseless, it's more appropriate to think in terms of what percentage of the overall defense mission can they handle on their own. And I think it's in both Saudi and American interest that the Saudis be able to do as much of that mission as possible, even if the United States would also have to be part of the effort.
Final question. Does the rise in military spending reflect a real new arms race in the Middle East?
Well, an arms race dynamic does exist in the sense that, yes, people respond to each other's actions. And so if you define an arms race as what you do affects what I do, which then affects what you do, and there can be this spiral effect where the budgets keep going up in that regard, then yes, there is some of that going on right now. However, I also think that the international sanctions on Iran have to some extent slowed down this dynamic. And the GCC countries and others are sort of catching up in terms of where they need to be. Now, that's not true everywhere. Obviously, it's not true in terms of the Syrian civil war. It's not true in terms of internal unrest in Bahrain or Iraq. It's not as if this broad statement can apply to each and every security problem in the region. But I would say overall that because the international community has managed to constrain Iran, at least in terms of its conventional military buildup, and to slow down its nuclear aspirations, that this has given some time for some of the other countries to catch up. So I hope it doesn't have the dynamic of an ongoing escalating arms race. But up until this point, I would say that, yes, there has been a certain amount of that kind of competitiveness and that kind of interactivity in the respective defense spending decisions of the different countries.
Michael O'Hanlon is the Director of Research for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. On April 27th, two popes, John the 23rd and John Paul II, will be made saints in a ceremony at St. Peter's Square in Rome. VOA's Jerome Sokolovsky says the dual canonization is part of the current pope's program to reconcile liberals and conservatives in the Roman Catholic Church.
Saint now has been the chant of Pope John Paul II's impatient fans since his death in 2005. Only 6 years later, the healing of this ailing Costa Rican woman was credited as his second required miracle. Pope Francis was then asked by the people in charge of the canonization when he wanted to schedule it, says Jesuit priest and Vatican watcher Thomas Rees.
And Pope Francis's response was, well, what about John the 23rd? And they said, well, he's only got one miracle, and he needs two miracles in order to become a saint, in order to be canonized. And his response was, says who? He's the Pope.
John Paul is certainly the better known of the two. The Polish Pope journeyed to the far corners of the earth, and his papacy is often believed to have accelerated the fall of communism. John the 23rd only became Pope in 1958, because the cardinals couldn't decide whom they wanted, says Rees.
He was an old man. They elected him as kind of a place setter.
But he convened the Second Vatican Council to modernize a seemingly anachronistic institution.
More than 2,000 representatives from almost every country in the world are meeting to review the position of the church in the space age.
This was an extraordinary move because we hadn't had an ecumenical council like this in a long, long time.
The council decided Mass no longer had to be in Latin and opened a dialogue with other faiths. Some traditionalists feel John the 23rd and the council went too far, while some liberals feel John Paul II was dogmatic and covered up clerical sex abuse. Francis wants to reconcile these groups, says Rees.
So this is a symbolic way for him to say, we're all one family, we're all united by Jesus Christ, and we can all come together to celebrate both of these men.
The two popes are both examples for clergy today, says Reverend Richard DeLillio, a professor of homiletics at Catholic University of America in Washington.
I think what they had that every preacher should have is dynamism. And the second thing they had that every preacher should have is that they preached what they believed and witnessed it.
And that, say fans of Francis, also describes the current pope. Jerome Sokolovsky, VOA News, Washington.
A U.S. research group says there is little evidence that North Korea will conduct a nuclear test during President Barack Obama's upcoming visit to Seoul. South Korea said this week it detected increased activity at a North Korean nuclear test site, suggesting an underground test could be imminent. Well, that's it for this edition of International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website. It's voanews.com. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington. Have a good day.